I was at a wedding about a month ago. Matter of fact, our whole family was at the wedding. Were you guys there at the Davis wedding? No, they were blowing it off. We had a family at our church get married, and we have this couple that have a home in this area called Loomis, and they have got acreage. It is gorgeous. And they had set up this wedding, and this wedding starts, and this freak storm hits. I mean, like, shocking. And so it starts, I call the church and I go, get all of our golf umbrellas over here. And they bring golf, and then I said, bring our pop-up tents. And they rush those things over there, and we had them ready. And then the pastor is up there, and he's doing the thing, and it starts sprinkling. And then it clouds up fast. I mean, this is a freak out of the middle of nowhere storm. Clouds rush in, and it starts raining. And this pastor was kind of a young, is this being taped? He's a very young, brilliant individual. But he's young. And so, you know how you kind of flex with the situation as you get older? He didn't flex. So, I mean, it starts raining hard, and he's going in the meaning of Hebrew words in the book of Genesis. And then they sung, what was it? They sung every verse of every song as it is dumping. That, what was it? That song was?
Come Thou Fount.
Yeah, Come Thou Fount of it. And it was coming, baby. I mean, it was pouring. Okay? And so we then start, so I get up, and a bunch of people, we get up, and we start sneaking umbrellas around. And this is a big wedding. I mean, it's got more than this many people, about twice this many people, outdoors, in chairs. It's beautiful. And so we end up sneaking, like the bride and groom are now under, and we got the relatives, are kind of, we had some old grandparents there, and we get umbrellas over them. And then we put up these pop-up tents, and pretty soon almost everybody has left the seats and is around the corners listening to these pop-up tents, and you can't hear the thing anyway. And it is pouring and pouring. And as I'm watching this whole, the rest of the story is this. On the other side of the stream, they have a full expensive reception set up that has gotten totally blown away and washed out. We have two Saturday night services at Bayside. So I call the folks at the Saturday night service, and I go, Teresa and a guy named Brian, I get them on the phone, and I go, here's the deal, man. I don't know if we're going to do this or not, but we may be sending a reception for 300 people our way fast. I go, can you handle it? Brian, who works, you know Brian Jenkins, he goes, whatever you need, consider it done. Guy's unbelievable. So I go, I talk to the dad, and he goes, he's in shell shock. He goes, I don't know what to do. I have 300 people. And so I go, you want to move to Bayside? He goes, is that possible? And I go, yeah, I already checked. He goes, he gets up and he goes, tell her, go to Bayside. He first of all, go change, then go to Bayside. So I go tearing over. Our Saturday night service is wrapping up. I go up behind Kurt, who's preaching, just wrapped up, tap on his shoulder so he doesn't dismiss him. And I look, our second service has about 600-700 people in it. And I just said, I told him what happened, and I said, how many of you would be willing to set up a reception? Nobody left. We had the chairs stacked in 1 minute, and in 15 minutes, we had tablecloths. We had candles. We had the whole nine yards. We had a head table, all this kind of stuff. A day, and they walked. It was stunning. We had pictures of the wedding anyway, thrown those up on the screen so the couple walked into them, graphics and the shots of their wedding. It was amazing, okay? You don't need to plan a wedding. But it was funny. As I was watching the wedding, I was sitting there going, who's married her? Wouldn't you agree? That's not the last storm that couple's going to experience. Okay? And so here's the, we're going to give you 1 minute to talk to people you're not currently married to. No spouse talk. Okay, so turn around, whatever. Okay, twos and threes. What storms hit couples and can wreck a marriage? What storms hit marriages and wreck them? You've only got a minute, and you can't talk to people you're married to. Ready, go. Thank you very much. Okay, we just want to hear some of these. What storms did you come up with? Okay, death of a child. Okay, what else? Well, raise your hands. Wait. Addictions. Okay. In-laws. Or how many of you have in-laws? How many of you have outlaws? Okay. Yeah. Finances. Okay. Yes. Lack of communication. Okay. Moving right along. Yes. illness. Same thing. Yeah, in other words, focus on children at the expense of a relationship with your spouse. Very smart. Yeah. Yeah. How many of you got married and went, oh, it's slightly different expectations? Yeah. Oh, John. We got the hell of you. Is it okay if he tells a story? Come up here. Let's give him a mic. This is good. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to deserve a round of applause because you won't be giving him one afterwards. All right. John Harris, a pastor.
Yeah, so I married my beautiful wife. And for most of the guys, when you get married, you've arrived. Just, you know, it's like, oh, I'm done. For the women, that's when the work just begins. And so anyways, me and Lori, we were married. I don't even know how long. How long were we married for? A couple of years. And I thought it was going great. She didn't think it was going so well. So one day, she came to me and said, I don't know about you, but I just had much bigger expectations than this. I looked at her and said, well, I guess you're going to have to lower your expectations. And I can tell you, 19 years later, I've never lived that down. So I'm glad that book came out, What Did You Expect? Because I'm going to go get it and give it to her. You're good.
How many of you guys, how many of you have your exact same story, sort of? Okay? Yeah, no guts, no glory. We want to begin by giving you three statistics.
That's right. The three statistics we want to give you is this. The average failed marriage lasts 7.2 years. The second one is the USA has the highest divorce rate. And the last one is over half of all divorce in the world is in the USA.
Interesting. Now, here's the deal. Take a look. The United States has the highest divorce rate in the world, and half of all divorce is in the USA. Every divorce will occur on the planet this year. Half of that will be in the United States of America. At least we're leading in something. Okay? That's right. And now, yeah, at some point you have to go, why is this? Here's the deal. You know what the problem is? Nobody's concerned about this. Okay? If Toyota or Lexus were making a car, half of them were breaking down in the national. If half of the kids in our school system were committing suicide, it would be an epidemic of concern. Nobody gives a rip about this, and yet I think it's destroying the fabric of our society more than bad cars. Okay? And I think it's because most people are not prepared by anything, by their parents, by their churches, or by for the fact that there are going to be three storms that hit every marriage, okay? And the first storm is, and just jot it in, the culture you live in. The first storm is the culture that we're living in, which does things to us we don't even realize, okay? Now, I want you to make sure you got a pen, pencil. Those of you that are teenagers going, what's he doing talking about marriage? You need to take better notes, okay? I think I'm going to look around. Any teenagers here without notes? Da, 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 da. Oh, good steel hits. Great. You're slick. That was a good move. Okay? You don't even have, they don't have pens. Paul? Okay, good job. Okay, who? All right. Back row. Here's a husband. No notes. That's not a good sign. Oh, she's taking notes for you? Okay. Now, here's what I want you to circle this. You ready? Realize this. In the last days, what does it say? Difficult times will come. And then it gives three reasons. For men, and of course it blames it on men. For men will be, number one, lovers of self. Circle that. Lovers of self. Second, lovers of money. And then it goes on to boastful, arrogant, revilers, disobedient, ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious, gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited. Sounds like a soap opera. And then it says lovers of pleasure. Circle that. Lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Interesting. You exegete this passage, and there's three reasons that our culture is going south. And lovers of self, lovers of money, and lovers of pleasure. Now, there are big words for these. Number one, lovers of self, that's humanism. Lovers of self is humanism.
Yeah, and we want to, I'm just going to read this quote. You have it, I think, on your outline. It says, a book, New Rules, gives an example. Among married people I interviewed for this book, those most devoted to self-fulfillment are having the most trouble in their marriages. Truly committed fulfillment seekers focus so sharply on their own needs that instead of achieving a more intimate, giving relationship, they grow further apart from each other. In looking to their own needs for fulfillment, they are caught in the debilitating contradiction. Their goal is to expand their lives by reaching beyond the self, but the strategy they employ results in constricting their lives, drawing inward in ever-narrowing, closed-off eye. People want to enlarge their choices, but by seeking to keep all the options open, they actually diminish them. That's kind of the culture we live in. 2 Timothy says also that they will be lovers of money, and that's materialism. Can't go back and forth from glasses okay. to no glasses.
So I want to make sure you got this. The culture, first is humanism. Second is materialism. Lovers of self, greedy for money. In other words, we can become so overcommitted and overextended trying to keep up with the neighbors that we actually don't have time for each other. And a good example of this is a little thing called the prenuptial agreement.
That's right. It's like a BC cartoon. It says BC is looking up the definition of a prenuptial agreement. And it says this, prenuptial agreement is an agreement between two people who love each other almost as much as they love their possessions.
That's good.
Yeah,
this is good.
And it's also like the lady who married four different husbands. One, a millionaire, then a film producer, then a butler, and then finally a funeral director. And someone asked her why, and she said, I married one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go.
J. Paul Getty, when he was the wealthiest man in the world, said this, quote, I would give my entire fortune for one happy marriage. Interesting, okay? Materialism, humanism. And the third one says this, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. By the way, does that describe our culture? Oh, good Lord. That's hedonism. That's hedonism. We live in an age of instant gratification. This playboy philosophy is loving pleasure more than loving God. If it feels good, do it. Forget values, morals, ethics. Just do whatever feels good.
Oh. A man wrote to Dear Abby recently, and she said, or he said, I'm in love and having an affair with two different women. I can't marry them both. Please tell me what to do, but don't give me any of that morality stuff. And Abby's answer is great. She says, Dear sir, the only difference between humans and animals is morality. Please write to a veterinarian.
by the way, storm number one, the culture you live in. And this is a really big deal, people. The Bible takes a lot of time to lay this out in a passage. And I think the Bible is psychologically brilliant here because it says lovers of self, lovers of money, loves of pleasure. That's the three dominant philosophies in our culture that I think are eroding marriages, humanism, materialism, and hedonism. And in a sense, it's me first, money first, pleasure first, and forget everything else, which is no foundation off to which to build a marriage. It's one of the reasons we talked about parenting the other day. When Christy and Leslie were high school freshmen, going into freshman year, I gave them a copy of a book called Interviewing Your Daughter's Date and had them read it, and then I took them out to dinner at a fancy restaurant. Girls, you remember where we went? Paul Martin's, okay? And I said, hey, here's the deal. I'm thinking that if a guy asks you out and that guy doesn't have enough guts to spend time with me, he probably doesn't have enough guts to take you out. And they agreed, and so I said, I'd love, before a guy takes you out, I'd just love to hang out, okay, and get to know the guy a little bit. And they were like, that's cool, because they were freshmen, and catch them early. And so I have this napkin, and I took the Paul Martin napkin, and I said, what advice, and matter of fact, all the college girls in here, wouldn't you love to do this, what advice would you give to a guy before he takes you out if you could. And I just took notes. I mean, it was awesome. I filled up a napkin and a half with stuff they said. You two should write a book. And I filled up this thing. And so a while later, a guy asked Christy out. And she said, hey, I'd love to go out with you. You got to talk to my dad first. So this guy comes in to see me. And I didn't want to beat up on the guy, stuff like that. I could tell he was nervous. And so he just came in. I said, hey, man, chill out. This isn't a big deal, okay? I just wanted to get to know you a little bit. We have a really cool talk. Matter of fact, I know dads that like to man up and tough out guys. I didn't want to be like that. Matter of fact, 2 weeks later, this guy called me and said, hey, I'm having some trouble at home. Can I come in and see you? So it was awesome. But then we get to the conversation part, and I said, hey, you've just asked my daughter out. And I said, first of all, you got great taste, okay? And then the second thing, I said, I really only got a couple things to tell you. And the first one is this. I said, my daughters are about the best gift God's ever given. And it's been my privilege from the day they were born, every day of their life, I've had the privilege of protecting them. I'm about to give you that responsibility for one night. Can you handle it? It was awesome. He goes, yes. Oh, good. Okay. And then second, I said, now about the physical stuff. And I could see him slink down in the chair. And I went, don't worry, dude. I got hormones too. So I said, here's the deal. You may touch my daughters on their back between their neck and their waist and nowhere else. And if you're cool with that, we're cool. He goes, I'm cool with that. So, and it was awesome. Okay. Probably 100 years ago, you didn't have to do stuff like this. But the culture we live in does not develop guys with character and integrity. It develops a whole lot of guys who are going, I love pleasure more than I love protecting your daughter. That makes sense? Okay? So this is kind of a big deal. By the way, there's a second storm. The second storm is this, the conflicts you live with. There's a culture you live in, and then there's conflicts you live with. Conversations like, well, your expectations are too high.
That's right. And conflicts are inevitable, right? I mean, we all are going to have conflicts. Bill Hybels, in his writings, he says the math of marriage is like this. You have one sinner plus one sinner equals two sinners. And then you add a few sinnerlings in there and watch out. And basically, when you and I run into a marriage that has lasted over the long haul, we need to know that they have, or a marriage that we respect a lot, we need to know that that couple has died to self hundreds of times. And they have had difficult conversations, they have compromised to each other, and they have said, I'm sorry, 1,000 times. Many people underestimate the work a marriage takes. And we are going to have conflicts. No matter what. No relationship, though, can survive the absence of forgiveness. And that's what we talked about this morning, huh, in our small groups. And it's so important in marriage. There's a great book on marriage called As For Me and My House, and it's by a guy named Walt Wangren. And it's an older book, but I believe it's still in print. And his whole thesis of that book, he writes it in a really different way. He basically just tells his story. But his whole thesis of the book is marriage is about forgiveness, and that's what takes the marriage the long haul. So no relationship can survive the absence of forgiveness.
That's right. So the culture you live in, the conflicts you will live through, and three, the crisis you'll live through. The crisis you'll live through. And crisis is going to hit every marriage in some form. And so on your... Here's the deal. College students, wake up for this. This is good. Nobody should be allowed to get married in America without knowing this next section here, okay? We believe this. The Bible teaches that all marriages go through three stages, okay? And so what we're going to do is we're going to cover this in about 5 minutes. So we're going to talk fast. You'll be able to write down these words. But here's the deal, okay? There are three stages in marriage in the Bible, okay? Now, stage one is illustrated in a book in your Bible called the Song of Solomon. It's in the book. It's in a brown wrapper, okay, in your book. And here's the deal. Write it in. It's the honeymoon stage. Stage one is the happy honeymoon, and it's the Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 1. Okay, now, if you are sitting next to your spouse, I'm going to have you read some Bible verses to your spouse. So now I'll read it and you just repeat. So look them in the eye. Okay, and college students, just watch, okay? Because all we're doing here is read them out. So if you're sitting next to your spouse, look them in the eye. Don't look at me. Look them in the eye, okay? And repeat after me, okay? Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling. Okay, now just the guys on this one. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are like doves. Your hair is like a flock of goats. Okay, that's not that good. Okay, we'll move on. Okay? Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn. Sorry. Okay. Here, each has its twin. By the way, just look at me. I love this guy's going. This boy, is he in the honeymoon stage? Oh, he's going, hey, your eyes, they're beautiful. Your hair, it's like a flock of goats. Hey, your teeth, you got two of them. Okay, look back at her again, guys. Here we go. Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. Your mouth is lovely. Give her a quick kiss. Go ahead. Come on. Your neck is like a Tower of David. Okay, here we go. Well, I'm not making this up. This is in the Bible. You ready, guys? Here we go. Verse 5. Here we go. Your two breasts are like two fawns. I will go to the mountain of myrrh. Don't go there right now. And then he said, verse 7. Guys, all right, here we go. How beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. This is the honeymoon stage now. Can you believe this stuff's in the Bible? Okay. All right, here we go. Write down these five words describe the honeymoon stage, and here it is. Intensity. Number one, intensity is focused attention. During this stage, guys will talk for hours. There, I only have eyes for you. You're head over heels in love. I'm zapped. I'm all shook up. Second is idealism. Idealism. There's a tendency to put the other person on the pedestal. By the way, how do you spell idealism? N-A-I-V-E, naive, okay? He's going, there is no flaw in you, okay? Third is this, indulgence. Indulgence. During this stage, there's a lot of giving in and a lot of giving up. During the honeymoon stage, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want? I don't know. What do you want to do? Okay. Intensity, idealism, indulgence. Number four, infatuation. Infatuation. The result of the first three is infatuation. I'm high. I'm in love. Everything's great. I'm great. She's great. Life's great. How many of you remember this? Okay. I'm great. She's great. Life's great. The world's great. Everything's great. There's a bounce in your step. Solomon puts it one more way. Verse 9. He says, you have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes. Okay? Now, would you say these four words with me? Intensity, idealism, indulgence, infatuation. There's one more word you got to add. Here it is. Here it is. Ignorance. Ignorance. In other words, fact is, would you agree? You have no clue who that person really is. Okay? You have no clue how low their expectations are going to be. You got no clue. Here's the deal. During the honeymoon stage, you're not in love with that person. You are in love with an idealized version of who that person is. Okay? And here's the deal. Fact, during the honeymoon stage, we tend to ignore difficulties. We overlook faults. We put difficulties aside. Any areas of conflict are swept under the... And you know what? Fact is, this stage can't last, shouldn't last, because you discover this. You got differences. You got difficulties. You got different temperaments, okay? There's more to life than just having. At some point, you got to take the trash out and start paying bills. So, by the way, so stage one floats off to the side, and you come to the end of stage one, and you come to the beginning of stage two. Now, stage two is described in Proverbs chapter 27. Okay, now just look up here. Don't look it up. I'll read it to you. Now, let me ask you a question. Who wrote the Song of Songs? Good. Who wrote Proverbs? Same guy, right? The same guy who is saying, there is no flaw in you. A little while later, is saying, Proverbs 27:15, a nagging wife is like a dripping faucet on a rainy day. Controlling her is like restraining the wind or grasping oil in your hand. Yeah, what's going on here? Everyone, there is no flaw in you. Nag, 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 nag. What's going on here is this. Stage two has arrived. Here it is. It is the despair stage. It is the despair stage, and five words describe this stage. And since Carol had a lot of experience with this stage, she does this one.
Yeah, this is the depressing stage, actually. First word is dullness. Dullness, it's back to the routine. Boredom is set in. You become complacent. You lose interest. The attitude in stage one is whatever you want, darling. Stage two is you want it, get it yourself. The second word is disagreements. You begin to clash over things. You begin to argue. You experience disharmony. Compassion seems to be replaced by criticism and constant conflict. The third word is defensiveness. Defensiveness. You're protecting self. You're not as open as you were before. You have an unwillingness to let your guard down. The communication breaks down because feelings that you've shared could be used as ammunition. We accuse and we excuse. We excuse ourselves and accuse our mates, and defensiveness builds up. You have dullness, disagreements, defensiveness, and the next word is disapproval. Before, Solomon is saying everything she does is right. Now it's nothing she does is right. It's what a change. You know, there's a lot of criticizing, a lot of blaming. It's like one wife said, my husband is temperamental. He's 90% temper and 10% mental. your compassion.
Or it's like the guy who said, I never believed in religion until a guy got married. Now I believe in hell because of her.
There you go. Compassion is replaced
stage
with
two.
Criticism. There's lots of jabs. It's a way to bury a marriage, actually, is a lot of little digs. And when dullness, disagreements, defensiveness, and disapproval set in, the last word is despair. So many people say, I feel cheated. I'm trapped. I don't know how to get out of this. The doubts come along. It's like, did I do the right thing? Did I make a mistake? It's like, what, was that Paul this morning that said that? Yeah. Did I make a mistake? Did I marry the right person? Why didn't I listen to my mother?
Can I ask you a question? Does this have the ring of psychological and relational truth to it? Bible's brilliant. Okay? I think it's the most brilliant psychology book ever written. Okay? Take a look at that. Stage two, dullness, disagreements. Matter of fact, let's say them out loud because we've all been there. Dullness, disagreements, defensiveness, disapproval, and despair. Now, here's the scary part. You know what this thing is? Doesn't take all five. I know some couples, it got dull, so I opted for a more exciting person and split. Other couples, we started fighting, and I thought, well, this can't be God's person for me. We don't agree on everything. If both of you agree on everything, by the way, one of you is not necessary. Okay? Defensiveness, disapproval, despair. Now, here's the problem. Those are the four, five little D's. They usually are responded to by the two big D's, which in here it is, divorce or depression. Okay? Divorce or depression, which means divorce is just split up, dump the bum, and start over, and before you do that, by the way, some of you in your blended family, you got in a divorce before, all kinds of guys, I don't want to dump any guilt on you. I want to say, stay committed to this marriage, okay? And read the book Virginia recommended the other day, okay? On, I tell you what, this book came out, it was groundbreaking material on the subject of divorce and how it kills kids. And nobody had the guts, mainstream media just buried it because they didn't want America to know, okay? Because people might feel bad, okay, and might not get divorced. Or here's the second one. A lot of Christians, though, they don't divorce. They're like, I'm a Christian. I'm stuck. I'm going to endure this out of faithfulness for God for the rest of my life, and we're just going to bank the fires and wait for it to die. Now, you know what's interesting is we've been in ministry for a long time. Whenever that happens, one of three things happen. They all start with the word break. There is either, number one, a breakup, or a breakdown. A breakup or a breakdown into just two separate lives, or third, a breakthrough. Because we believe this. The Bible teaches there are three stages, not two stages. And stage three is described in 1 Californians chapter 13. And it is the deeper love stage. It is the deeper love stage. In other words, there is a place on the other side of stage two that is better than the honeymoon stage, because now you are in agape love, but you're not afraid it's going to dissolve, because everybody secretly knows this honeymoon stage ain't lasting, okay? And can we have a fight and still stay together, okay? And now, what we want to do is, you can ignore right what's below that. We have a little more complex information than is there. We want to give you six ways to move from stage two to stage three, okay? And we're going to wrap this up by walking you through how to keep your marriage growing no matter what stage it's in, okay? And I love this. Notice the verse at the top, Proverbs 24:3. Homes are built on the foundation of circle wisdom and understanding. And then Philippians, Paul says, I pray that your love will keep on growing because of your good looks and it says because of your circle knowledge and circle insight. In other words, the best way to build a lasting, God-honoring, deeply fulfilling marriage is to have an increase in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and insight, and we're going to unpack that for you. And this is going to sound remarkably familiar to parenting, but step one is this. Keep your cool. Keep your cool. Chill out. We had a fight. Chill out. Okay, keep your cool. And we want to give you three really great truths about marriage that nobody knows.
Right. The first one is God never said marriage would be easy. He never said marriage would be easy. And we can kind of prove it by how different we are. I wrote a list of...
How many of you married somebody and you went, oh, they're different than me? Okay? Carol got, I think, so frustrated one day by that, she made a list.
Okay, so Ray's a late night person. I'm an early morning person. To relax, I engage in conversation. To relax, Ray disengages. Ray likes resorts. I like bed and breakfast. I like to stop and smell the roses. Ray's driving so fast, he runs over them. Ray's a visionary. I'm a realist. Ray's a speaker. I'm a listener. it's kind of funny. Kid said. Ray has lots of ideas. I have lots of reasons why they won't work. Ray loves to spend money. I like to save it. Ray loves to give money away. I don't. Ray likes Colgate. I like Crest. I like a hamburger with everything on it. He likes some just plain, says the way the good Lord made it. I like to sit at a table and eat. Ray likes the drive-thru. Late at night, I want conversation. Late at night, Ray wants something else.
Wait, how many of you guys would go, amen? All right, thank you very much.
Ray walks in a...
kindred spirit. She's dying of embarrassment right now.
Ray walks in a crowded room and talks to dozens of people. I walk in and talk to two. Ray likes late night TV. I like to sleep. Ray juggles a job and schedule. I juggle kids. Ray has a short fuse and then it's over. I have a long one, but it lasts a long time. Ray's the life of the party, and I'd rather organize it. So we're pretty different. How many of you would say that you could write a similar list to that?
And you know, here's the problem with this. Every couple we've talked to that bust their home apart, you ask them, why are you getting divorced? They have the same stupid answer. We're just not compatible. But nobody's compatible, okay? And here's the deal. This is a big deal, okay? God and Christians are dumber than the general public on this one, okay? God never said marriage would be easy. Oh, if it's God's person for me, you know what I mean? It's just stupid, okay? God never said marriage. Second, God never said change would come quickly. And third, God never, this is a really big deal. No woman should be allowed to get married without memorizing this one.
God never said my mate would meet all my needs. And I can't tell you how strongly we feel about this. I think it's really important when you go into marriage to know, and those of you that are unmarried right now, for you to be a complete whole person on your own, individually, with God, is the best gift you can give to a marriage. Because there's three truths here, and that is marriage will not end your aloneness, it won't heal your brokenness, and it won't assure your happiness. Even in the best of circumstances, a spouse can only meet a certain amount of needs, and it's just not going to meet all your needs. In fact, this verse here says, in Philippians, it says, and my God will meet all your needs according to the riches of his glory in Christ Jesus. And I just love that, because when you come to marriage, it's God who meets our needs, and then what we give in the marriage is an overflowing of what he's given to us personally. And that's the ideal. It's not that you've married Mr. Perfect and he meets all your needs. You know, I remember when I was single, before Ray and I got together, and this gal that was married, who was not, she would consider herself completed after she got married, not before. And I remember she really was pushing me, you know, I would like you to meet this person or this person. And I'm thinking, I am fine, just who I am, you know. And I think her mindset was, it's like a half a person and a half a person get together and make a whole person. And unfortunately, that marriage didn't survive. But it's really important to remember who meets our needs.
Yep. By the way, you know what's interesting is, I should have put something up, I got to write. The Bible in Genesis says two become one. This is lousy math, people. When you're, I'm your financial advisor, that's not good math. One plus one equals one in the Bible, okay? So what's happened is, a lot of Christians, they just refigure the math. They go, okay, one half plus one half equals one. In other words, I'm an unfulfilled person, so are you, and you put two unhappy people together thinking they're going to get a happy marriage, okay? Or a lot of Christian dominant men go, oh, I'm the head of the home. One and she's a zero equals one. That happens in conservative Christianity all the time. And you go, no, no, no. One full person plus another full person, put them together, God does something miraculous. Okay? And so number one is this, keep your cool. God, would you say this out loud with us? God never said marriage would be. He never said change would come. And God never said my mate would meet all my needs. Number two is this, keep feeding your soul. Keep feeding your soul. I have a lot of stuff to say about this that I'm going to skip, because all I have to do is ask us, how many of you are in better shape spiritually and relationally right now than you were before you got here? You know what this thing is? It's not the magic island with its stingrays and sharks and baked Alaska. You know what it is? your soul is being fed to a higher degree probably than it was before you got here. Okay? You build that into your life because it'll have a ripple effect. The third is this, okay? Number one, keep your cool. Second, keep feeding your soul. That is a big deal. I wish we had time to unpack it. Number three is this, keep committed. Keep committed. Just go, you know what? Divorce is not an option. Fire escape's not an option. Moving into separate rooms, not. Stay committed to each other. And to show you the benefit of watching The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, we are at a table, and we're working on one of my messages a year ago, and the message is on marriage and on commitment in marriage, okay? And so, Leslie, well, tell them what you told me. You remember? And what was going on in The Bachelorette? This guy he's been divorced. She's trying to figure out if he's going to run again, if he's the guy. And he's a very good-looking, very attractive, very cool dude. And is Leslie, that's a perfect way to put it. Watch this guy dig himself a hole. Can we get the lights turned off for this one? Ladies and gentlemen, for the first time ever at Campus by the Sea, The Bachelor.
Now, your relationship, when it closed off, is it something that was completely closed, or is there still residual feeling or resentment or anything like that?
You know, I'm always going to care about my ex-wife. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were together so long, just all through college, you know, college right. Sweetheart. So the love was gone. The passion was gone. So I don't want you to worry about that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been almost 3 years now. I just have a void in my life right now, and I know exactly what it is. It's just finding an awesome woman again, you know. Mm-hmm. And my ex-wife was awesome, you know. It just didn't work out. We both just fell out of love, and I hate that term. I don't know if that exists, but I guess I don't know how to really explain it.
So I'm wondering, is that something, like, how are you going to deal with that now? Like, if you were to be in a new relationship and you lost the passion, or how do you keep the passion alive?
I'm not the type of guy that gives up on anything, okay. Ever. I know you were upset last week, and it just killed me because I would not be here if I didn't see some kind of connection or I wanted to get to know you more or right. Whatever else. So, but you're a sweetheart, and you're beautiful, and thanks, I would okay. Love to get to know you better.
So if that's your daughter, what's your advice? Run, absolutely. Here's the deal. Those of you that are college students, just listen to this. Whenever we're speaking to college students on this, we basically go, when is someone ready to get married? At what age? Bingo. When somebody has illustrated a high capacity for staying committed to something that's tough, they are now ready to get married. Okay? That's it. You don't want when somebody's illustrated a high capacity for staying committed when things get tough, that's good. Now, the next three, we're going to put them together because they're all sort of the same thing. Here we go. Number four is this, keep encouraging the other person. Number five on that, with words and physical stuff, keep showing affection. The best thing I ever heard on sex came from, believe it or not, a German theologian who said, you can summarize what the Bible says about sex with four words. And I'm going, this ought to be good. And he said, here it is. Keep sex in marriage. He said, if you're single, the Bible says, keep sex in marriage. And if you're married, the Bible says, keep sex in marriage. Isn't that great? That's brilliant. Little German theologian stuff, all free of charge. Keep encouraging, keep on showing affection, and last is this, keep on giving affirmation. keep on giving affirmation, encouraging each other, affirming each other. If you'd keep your notes out, I want to read this if I can get through this. This is hard to read. So just keep your notes out and look up here. This guy says, when I sailed to the island of Kiniwata, an island in the Pacific, I took along a notebook. And after I got back, it was filled with descriptions of flora and fauna. But the only note that I wrote that still interests me is this. Johnny Lingo paid 8 cows to Sarita's father. And I don't need to have it in writing. I'm reminded of it every time I see a woman belittling her husband or a wife withering under her husband's scorn. I want to say to them, you should know why Johnny Lingo paid 8 cows for his wife. Johnny Lingo lived on the island of Kiniwata. That's what Shenkin, the manager of the guest house, told me. Shenkin was from Chicago and mentioned Johnny a lot. Johnny was mentioned by many people in many connections. If I wanted to spend a few days on the neighboring island of Nurumbandi, Johnny Lingo could put me up. If I wanted to fish, he could show me where the biting was best. If it was pearls I sought, he would bring me the best buys. The people of Kiniwata all spoke highly of Johnny Lingo. Yet, when they spoke, they smiled, and their smiles were slightly mocking. Get Johnny Lingo to help you find what you want. Let him do the bargaining, advised Shenkin. Johnny knows how to make a deal. Johnny Lingo, a boy nearby, hooted the name and rocked with laughter. What goes on, I demanded. Everybody tells me to get in touch with Johnny Lingo and then breaks up. Let me in on the joke. Oh, the people like to laugh, Shenkin said. Johnny's the brightest, the strongest young man in the islands, and for his age, he's the richest. But if he's all you say, what's there to laugh about? Oh, only one thing. 5 months ago at Fall Festival, Johnny came to Kiniwata and found himself a wife, and he paid her father 8 cows. I knew enough about island customs to be shocked. 2 or 3 cows would buy a spectacular wife. Good Lord, I said, 8 cows. She must have beauty that takes your breath away. Well, she's not ugly, he conceded, but only the kindest could call Sarita plain. Sam Carew, her father, was afraid she'd be left on his hands. But then he got 8 cows for her? Isn't that extraordinary? Never been paid before, yet you call Johnny's... No, I said it would be kind to call her plain. She was skinny. She walked with her shoulders hunched and her head ducked. She was scared of her own shadow. Well, I guess there's no accounting for love. True enough, said the man, and that's why the villagers grin when they talk about Johnny. They get kind of satisfied by the fact that the sharpest, richest young man in the islands was bested and conned by her dad, Sam Carew. But how? No one knows, and everyone wonders. All the cousins were asking Sam to ask for 3 cows and hold out for 2 until he was sure Johnny would pay 1. Then Johnny came to Sam Carew and said, Father of Sarita, I offer 8 cows for your wife, for your daughter. 8? Never. The 8 cows, I murmured, I'd like to meet this Johnny Lingo. Well, I wanted fish and I wanted pearls, so the next afternoon I beached my boat at Nurumbandi. And I noticed as I asked directions to Johnny's house that his name brought no sly smile to the faces of his fellow Nurumbandians. And when I met the slim, serious young man, when he welcomed me with grace to his home, I was glad from his own people he had respect unmingled with mockery. We sat in his house and talked. Then he asked, you come here from Kiniwata? Yes. Do they speak of me on that island? Yes, they say there's nothing that I might want that you can't help me get. He smiled gently. My wife is from Kiniwata. Yes, I know. They speak of her? A little. What do they say? The question caught me off balance. I said, well, they told me you were married at festival time. Nothing more? The curve of his eyebrows told me he knew there was more. They also say the marriage settlement was 8 cows, I paused, and they wonder why. They asked that. His eyes lit up with pleasure. Everyone in Kiniwata knows about the 8 cows. I nodded. He said, and everyone in Nurumbandi knows it too. His chest expanded with satisfaction. Always and forever, when they speak of marriage settlements, it will be remembered that Johnny Lingo paid 8 cows for Sarita. So that's the answer, I thought. Vanity. And then I saw her. I watched her enter the room to place flowers on the table. She stood still a moment to smile at the young man beside me. Then she went swiftly out again. She was easily the most beautiful woman I have ever laid my eyes on. The lift of her shoulders, the tilt of her chin, the sparkle in her eyes all spelled a confidence to which no one could deny her the right. I turned back to Johnny Lingo, and I found him looking at me. You admire her? He murmured. She's glorious, but she's not Sarita from Kiniwata. He said, there is only one Sarita. Perhaps she does not look the way they say she looked on Kiniwata. I blurted out. She doesn't. I heard she was homely. They all make fun of you because you let yourself be cheated by Sam Carew. He looked at me and said, you think 8 cows were too many? No, but how can she be so different? He said, do you ever think what it must mean to a woman to know that her husband has settled on the lowest price for which she can be bought? And then later, when the women talk, they boast of what their husbands paid for them. One says 4 cows, maybe the other 5. How does she feel, the woman who was only sold for 1 or 2? That could not happen to my Sarita. Then you did this just to make your wife happy? I wanted Sarita to be happy, yes, but I wanted more than that. You say she's different. That's true. Many things can change a woman. Things that happen inside, things that happen outside, but the thing that matters most is what she thinks about herself. And in Kiniwata, Sarita believed she was worth nothing, and now she knows she is worth more than any woman in the islands. I said, then you want it. He said, I wanted to marry Sarita. I loved her and no other woman. But, he finished softly, I wanted an 8-cow wife. Keep encouraging, showing affection, give an affirmation. We're over time. Thanks for listening. We hope this is helpful.